Downloading. 98%. 99%. Download complete. The episode will begin in
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Tech Talk, the technology show for blind and partially sighted people. Your hosts this week are...
Hello, I'm Stephen Scott.
I'm Sean Preece.
And me, Tim Schwartz.
Hey! Yes, hello, welcome along once again to Tech Talk, the technology show if you're blind or partially sighted. Even if you're fully sighted, you know what? You're welcome. We don't exclude here. That's not what we're about. This is an inclusionist programme. Is that a word? I have no idea.
It is now.
Yeah, it is now, exactly. Hi, guys. Welcome along to the programme. Tim, Sean, how are you guys doing?
Very good. Very good, thank you. How was your holiday?
It wasn't a holiday. For goodness sake,
sorry.
It wasn't a holiday. I just decided to give myself some peace for a week from you two.
I'm offended.
Oh, well, we see how it is. Fine. I was going to say I'm doing well, but now I'm a bit offended. But that's okay.
Oh, the snowflake generation. Right, we have got so much to get through. Great to be back with you. Thank you, Tim, especially to you for hosting last week. You did a reasonable job. And
well done. Sean,
I
appreciate it. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and we had a good time with it.
You did. And Sean, thank you for whatever it is you did last week. I really have no idea.
It's the magic in the background. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, it's like the swan, isn't it? The swan that's swimming gracefully on top.
Or the ugly
duckling. Yeah, I think that might be a better one. Right, okay. We've got lots to get through this week. We're going to be talking about Apple, of course, and their latest announcements relating to education. Bit of a snore fest, if I'm honest, but we'll get to that. Also, we'll find out how accessible Chromebooks are. We've promised to talk about them for some time. We have a sighted trainer from Ireland called Sharon Lyons joining us today to tell us about Chromebooks and all of the accessibility they have. And I'm quite excited about this. We have one to watch for you. And, you know, we haven't really done this in the show for a while, but this is a mobility device that gives you information on your surroundings, such as obstacles in front of you. I'm going to tell you all about that coming up on Tech Talk. Plus, of course, all of our nonsense as well. It's all coming up for the next hour. Stay with us.
You can't say that.
I just did. Yeah, so hello. It's nice to be back. It is lovely to be here with you guys. And taking a week off makes you realise what you miss in life. And your nonsense, I missed. So there you go.
That's almost poetic. Thank you.
Thanks,
almost.
Steven.
Yeah.
We missed you as well.
Almost Shakespearean.
Well, I never.
Well, I did.
Do you know what? Okay. I think Tim's thinking, that's great, I've had a chance to host. Sean's thinking, when do I get a shot?
No, I'm not. Believe me.
The ego's kicking in, I think. But no, listen, we're going to talk lots about Apple this week because, you know, they had an event. I say lots about it. I think we'll talk about it for a little while and then we'll move on to anything else. But because if I'm totally honest with you, it wasn't a great event. I wasn't impressed by this. But then I don't have children, so I don't care about what kids do at school. It's not no interest to me. But, you know, you guys have kids, so you might have a passing interest in this. Basically,
I don't need to have children to care about and be passionate about children's education, Stephen. I believe that children are the future.
Sean, this isn't Live Aid, right? It's not Live Aid. This is Tech Talk, right? We're talking about technology, and there wasn't that much technology to talk about at the event. Tim, back me up.
Well, I have to say that you're right. From a standpoint of not having children, this may not have meant a whole lot to some people. But if you are a student or an educator, there was some good news that came out of this, some helpful things that Apple's trying to do to integrate themselves into the classroom. So I don't know. I think there was some good news from the education standpoint. But to the greater population, yeah, maybe not so much. Although, that being said, if I can get an iPad for $300 on a discount, I'm all in.
Yeah, well, that is, I guess, the only thing we can talk about. And, you know, in fairness to it, although I think the whole event, I was maybe expecting a bit more. I have to say, guys, I was kind of building myself up for a March event. And then I get so excited because I heard about it last week when I listened to Tech Talk. And I heard the show and I didn't know there was going to be an event. And I heard you guys talking about it. I was, oh, yes. And then you said, it's an education event. Oh, no. and I know why they've done it, because they're obviously keen to get back into the classroom. There's a huge market there. Lots of companies now are on this. Google are on it. We're going to talk a bit about Google later, of course, with the Chromebooks. But, you know, they've actually brought out a new Chrome tablet. Well, I say they have, Acer have. They've brought it out. They've got the first Google Chrome OS on there, the operating system. Now, what does that mean? Well, essentially what they're trying to do, I guess, is to compete with Apple. The, you know, interestingly, that announcement came out a day before the launch of the new iPad from Apple. So, you know, good timing. And actually, they priced it around $250. So, not sure what that will translate to in pounds. It probably will be similar, I'd imagine. But that is an interesting place for the conversation to begin, because, of course, Apple and education, you know, I go back to my school days, 1992, Apple were huge in schools at that time. You know, my school was full of them, or at least were starting to grow the amount of computers, and they were all Apple computers. And that was really where I learned about Macs and kind of fell in love with them, if I'm honest. So, you know, Apple know that if they get into the market young, then people will stay with them through their lives. Not always. That's not always the case, of course. But, you know, that certainly seems to be where they're heading. But it was this iPad that they launched, which is essentially an upgrade to last year's iPad that they just sort of put out there. It was like, you know, they just left out in the street for someone to take a picture of.
You're being very dismissive, Steve.
No,
come on.
I'm not being. I mean, it was an iPad they brought out last year, which, you know, it came out with very little fanfare, is really what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it wasn't a bad idea. In fact, actually, I think for people, especially a lot of our audience who are listening, who might be thinking, should I buy an iPad? Would I want to buy an iPad? Well, this is maybe the time to think about it, because the price point has gotten so low. But let's maybe get into the specs of this. And guys, I know you two, you're getting very excited about this, that, you know, it's got all the latest innards. I mean, I know, Sean, for example, you're excited by the new processor that it's got. We'll just fall asleep, Tim, while he talks, okay?
Okay, I'll wake you when I've finished.
If you don't mind.
This is so exciting. For an entry-level iPad like this, the processor in it, the brains, if you like, is a A10X Fusion. Now, that just the name alone makes me excited, but this is the same processor that you will find in last year's 10 and 12-inch iPad Pros. And everyone was going, how much performance were in those iPads, the Pros? So for entry level, you're getting the same level of performance. That's not exactly true, because the Pros do have some extra things in there, more memory that will give extra performance.
Better camera as well, isn't it? A better camera on the Pro than it would be on the iPad?
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, okay. So, and there's four speakers on the Pro as well, which is, this one doesn't have. But I mean, just from a performance point of view, this is going to be able to run the latest iOS. It's going to be able to run iOS 12. The performance of it from the A10X Fusion chip is going to be fantastic, up there with the, you know, with the premium flagship models. So if you're willing to do away with the bells and whistles of the new design, such as the camera, it's only got 8-meg camera on this one, whereas it's a 12-megapixel on the Pro. This one's got Touch ID. It's only got the one speaker. It's very much the old design of iPads that you'll be used to. But the performance level of it is going to be fantastic. And I think for that price, it's definitely, I would get one. I haven't touched an iPad since the iPad 3, just because the usefulness and the price point of it was just a little bit too much for me. But this one, I'm definitely interested in.
Okay. Tim?
You know, I have to say that I do agree from that standpoint, because yes, it's not going to be design-wise comparable to the Pros, but all the innards that they have upgraded, like Sean said, I think really make this worth that price point. I think that's the key. If they had released this and it was, you know, $400, $500, I don't think that it would have been worth that price point. But when you're saying, okay, after a $30 discount in the US for the educational, you know, discount, and you can get this at $300, I think that that's a great entry level for any iPad. And it's something to definitely consider. I think that with these upgrades, with the things that they've done with this iPad, it's worth it. Whether you're a student or not, just wanting an entry-level iPad, I think this is definitely worth the pickup.
Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? It's those people who are entry level. Although I don't think this is an entry level device. I mean, I think we'd all agree that the iPad is generally, whatever version you buy, is probably going to be head and shoulders above most other tablets. Oops, there I said it. But, you know, it's probably going to be, it will be a quality product. And with that Retina display, the faster processor, camera's still okay.
More than enough.
It's enough, though, yeah, exactly. And I'll be honest, I've had an iPad Pro now for about, just under, actually about a year. And I don't use the camera in it. I very rarely have ever used the camera. So, you know, I use my phone for that. So my phone is the iPhone 7 Plus. It's got a good camera in it. I'm happy with that. So, you know, this is one I would buy for my mum and dad because, you know, they're not massive techies. They just, you know, like to play solitaire and silly games, Candy Crush or whatever. So, you know, they love doing all that and that's fine. They're not, they do have sight problems, but they do, you know, they're not massively technical. They would love this kind of thing. So, you know, and I think about the price point again, two of those for Christmas equals less than the cost of an iPad Pro. It's pretty obvious economics.
And that being said, Stephen, the other thing that I think is notable, although I don't know how much it applies to somebody who's blind or visually impaired, but this new iPad does offer Apple Pencil support. They are offering that for students to be able to interact with several different apps that they're creating for the classroom. So to be able to have Apple Pencil support on this as well, because of its processing power, I think that makes it interesting as well. Of course, you have to pay extra for the Apple Pencil, but if they do have some reasons to use it, especially with ARKit, they're talking about using Apple Pencil with different apps that use ARKit. So it could be something interesting. Like I said, maybe not as much for somebody who's visually impaired, but that is something I think is notable for this.
Okay, so here's my question. Because I was kind of picked up on this. I made this comment to someone and I said, you know, yeah, Apple Pencil, great if you can see what you're doing. But someone said to me, well, actually, if you've got a little bit of vision, because obviously, you know, people who are visually impaired, not completely blind, will have a wide range of experiences in regards to sight. So, you know, one person might be able to see enough to be able to use it to read even small print or write small print. Others might not be able to do any of that at all. But the fact is that there are some visually impaired people who might find the pencil useful. So we maybe shouldn't write it off as early as perhaps maybe I've done in the past. Because I bought an Apple Pencil. And I put it into the category of a device which I do have no idea why I bought.
Hang on, hold the phone. You bought an Apple Pencil. I wasn't informed of this.
I bought an Apple Pencil. I bought it ages ago. I got it with my iPad Pro, actually. And I was really, you know, I thought this is great. I'll use it for taking notes because I'd heard about apps that you could write and it would turn it into text. And I thought this could be really useful. But unfortunately, my writing is what I would call a bad doctor handwriting, and it is impossible to understand. And you know, no matter how intelligent computers get, even the iPad said, sorry, I'm out, I have no idea what he's just written.
I have no idea what use case there can be for the Apple Pencil for the visually impaired. I'm quite happy to keep saying that. If anyone knows any different, then let us know, but I can't think of any practical use. And in fact, even in the classroom, I'm not sure how much a difference an Apple Pencil will make. I just can't see what use it is for, you know, general use, maybe for art and things like that. But otherwise, I can't see schools in particular, you know, paying out for Apple Pencils.
Okay. Tim, you're very quiet on this one. Are you siding with Sean here?
You know, I'm kind of split on the Apple Pencil because I think as a selecting type device, so you can use it to select buttons or to select links, things like that, that can maybe be helpful, especially if you're somebody, not necessarily visually impaired, but somebody who has mobility issues or issues with your hands or paralysis, things like that. So for somebody with those types of disabilities, if you can use maybe one hand but not the other, maybe it's easier to use a pencil than your hands or you know, something like that. But for the visually impaired, I don't know. I haven't used one. And tried to use it. Is there a use case? Very possibly, but I'm just not personally aware of it. Like Sean said, I'm sure there probably is, and we're just not aware of what that use case is. So like I said, I'm torn on it. I haven't done it personally, but I'm sure there's got to be some good use for it.
I think the answer then in that case is a cheap stylus. You know, you could buy a cheap stylus for a couple of quid. You know, I was at an event once where it was with a charity and they were giving stylus. Just making up words today. But they were giving them away. And I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, I've got this. In fact, it was really clever, although I have to say it was just a short story here. It was really funny and really dangerous all at the same time, because they were giving away the style eye with... So it was a stylus, so it had a kind of rubber bottom, like, you know, almost like the opposite end of a pencil, or like a rubber end of a pencil. And it had that, but you could also click it at the top to turn it into a pen, and the pen would actually push through the rubber bit. So if you forgot to unclick your pen and started tapping and mashing away at your iPad, you would smash it into bits.
So that's handy.
Know, yeah, free, but with danger. So, yeah, but no, I think a cheap stylus, which is a couple of quid, versus an pencil, which is 100 quid. Yeah, I have to say, for visually impaired people, I would struggle. But, I, you know, we're open to ideas here. So if you've come up with one, do tell us. There was lots more in the event we could talk about around schools and classrooms. My advice would be, if this is your thing, do check it out. I think Apple were right not to live stream this, because they knew the majority of people would not be fascinated by this. It was really an education schools focused program. It was a very good program, in the sense that the software they brought out, the ideas they've come up with for classrooms, is brilliant. And one thing we can be fairly sure of, not 100%, but fairly sure of, is that everything that Apple does will be accessible. And they did mention accessibility at one point, which kind of made me feel better. Even though they didn't mention it in the context of the software, they mentioned it in the context of the event around education. And that's the first time I've ever heard that. So nice to hear that shoehorned in. But yeah, we'll talk more about it as the weeks go on. If you have had a use case for an Apple Pencil, tell us, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Just a quick point before we move on. The podcast... A couple of emails have been coming in about the podcast. We have made a bit of a change. We've put together our episodes and our features feed into one, and we've left both. So you have two Tech Talks currently running on the Apple iTunes website, and on Audioboom, it's just one at the moment. If you've subscribed to either, just be aware that you may have to resubscribe at some point, because we'll have to drop one of them, because Apple won't allow us to have two. So we've merged everything into one, the idea being that you can get lots more from Tech Talk, and that is generally the idea. Instead of just the weekly show that you get in that feed, you're also, as of now, and if you go to the feed now, you'll find lots more audio content, some great stuff there, some great interviews. We're just about to put one up about Hive, which a lot of people have been asking about, and there's lots of other topics of some bonus content, if you like, on that podcast. So really excited, and some great content from across RNIB on that channel. So yeah, exciting stuff. Check it out. Search for RNIB Tech Talk. That is the name of the new feed, RNIB Tech Talk. If you've already subscribed, you should already still be, and all shall be well. Tell us what you think. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Now, to Chromebooks. And we've had a lot about Chrome in the past week. As I mentioned earlier, Acer have announced a new 10-inch tablet with the Chrome OS, the first tablet to have this. But what about accessibility on Chrome OS? Now, it does have a screen reader built-in called ChromeVox, but how good is it? Well, we got an email a few weeks back, you might remember, telling us about a woman called Sharon Lyons, who lives in Ireland. She joined me on the programme to talk a little bit about Chrome and Chromebooks in particular. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Steve.
Listen, great to have you here, Sharon, because we've been getting a lot of emails in recently about Chromebooks. And yes, your name came up. I don't know how popular you are or not popular you are, but your name popped up. And as a result, we were very keen to get you on the programme to talk a little bit more about Chromebooks. And I guess dispel any myths that perhaps I've got. I've been accused of being a little unfair to Chromebooks about, you know, the whole kind of experience I had, which was going into a store, trying one and getting the dreaded button while I was navigating. And I thought, well, if that's all a Chromebook can do, they can keep it. Tell me they're different, Sharon.
Yes, well, they're certainly different. I mean, the reason I got into Chromebooks really was last summer. I actually teach touch typing to kids, and I was just looking at different kind of devices that I could teach for the classes, you know, on these devices, to have something very what's the word, very standard for them all to use. So they were all accessing the same system for learning to touch type. And I obviously needed something kind of cheap as well. Mm-hmm. And the system that they use is web-based. So I thought, great. And I'd heard a lot about, when I started looking into Chromebooks, they used a lot in education because they're very simple to use. And you can kind of set them up out with whatever you want someone to access on the Chromebook. So you could have like an online course or an online exam or something, and you just stick the Chromebook in front of the person and say, there you go, do the exam, something like that. So it's very a very straightforward machine to use. I mean, it's a laptop, essentially. I love the keyboard. I teach touch typing. I learned to touch type a long time ago. Best thing I ever learned. I am actually fully sighted, but I hate using the mouse. Mm-hmm. I just find it really annoying. And also because I teach people with vision impairment, I teach screen reader users. So I need to know the keyboard shortcuts, and it just so happens I love them, and I wrote a website all about them, and I'm trying to get them out to the wider world. So I like keys. I don't like touch screens. I actually find it very hard to type on touch screens, and I've tried Bluetooth keyboards and things, and it hasn't really worked for me. But a Chromebook you can get in any size, because essentially it's a laptop running the Chrome OS operating system. And so I have actually, my Chromebook is an 11-inch screen, but the keyboard on it is very standard. Okay, it has a touchpad, but I don't have to use that. It's very light as well. It's 1.1 kilograms. And it's something that I'm almost using as a notebook, the same way as someone might use a tablet, if you see what I mean. So, and of course, tablets, touch screens, tablets. So I know you can get kind of stands to put them on, to tilt them so you can kind of see the screen and that. And I know that would only be relevant to certain people, but I just find them very awkward to use. So if I can get a small laptop and I can adjust the screen, you know, and I have a standard keyboard that I can use, I just find that just much better than a tablet. So that's kind of where I'm coming from on the Chromebook. The Chromebook, it's very fast to boot up and update and everything compared to Windows.
Oh, don't get me started on that. Don't even get me started on Windows updates.
Yeah, just a few more little bits to do.
Several
after the 100%.
Days later. Yeah, exactly. Or just finishing things up or something, it says on the screen, you know, which takes off in half an hour. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
An update on a Chromebook is just go to restart for the update, and it basically updates it in the time that it takes to restart the computer. Like, it's just like switching it off and on again.
That's incredible. Because it is, because it's all web. This is the bit I can't get my head around.
Okay.
It has got a hard drive in it.
So it has.
You can save stuff to it, but it's not really for that. Is that right? I mean, it's essentially only for using on the web. So going on Google or going to Office Online or, you know, using those web applications, not physical applications. You know what I mean? Applications that you would save on your hard drive.
Yes, yeah. Essentially, it's a web browser. It's a machine with a web browser on it, and that's what you use. And you know, it's designed to kind of use it with cloud storage, essentially Google Drive, of course, because it's Google made. But you can store files offline. You can store files on it. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of storage, depending on the model that you buy, but there is a USB port as well, so you can plug a USB into it and work off of that, you know, a memory stick or external drive, you know, so you can work offline, but essentially it's designed to work with the web.
Okay, all right. So that's all fine. Okay, I think I've got my head around that.
Mm-hmm.
What about accessibility?
Okay, well, out of the box, you switch the machine on and you do Control-Alt-Z and ChromeVox starts up. So ChromeVox is the screen reader on Google Chrome, on a Chromebook. And the voice starts up. And, okay, you can tab around. So if you're used to moving around with keys, you know, you can use your arrows and your tab. And if you're used to keyboard shortcuts in a web browser, like the standard ones, like Control-T for a new tab, Control-W to close, that's what you use, essentially. So you do Control-T, and it brings up a Google Start page, you know, the Google search.
Hmm.
And you kind of go from there.
In terms of, I mean, and I bring up ChromeVox, which is the speech software, because I have seen a few of these. And unless you're going to spend a fair amount of money, like, for example, the Google Chromebook Pixel, it's called, isn't it? That's about £1,000. I mean, it's a lot of money. And if you're going to buy that, really what you're buying it for is the screen. You've got touch screen there. You've got a very high-definition screen. Some of the lower-end ones, the ones I've seen about £200, £250, they tend to have what I would say very poor quality displays. And I say that as a person who doesn't really use the screen, but if I was to use a laptop screen, it would need to be really bright and it would need to be really clear. I mean, the Dell XPS range of laptops was the only screens I had ever seen on a laptop that I thought, wow, because they were so bright and vivid. But then you're spending £1,200. What do you expect? I would expect that. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily see the poor quality display on a Chromebook as a negative if you're completely blind or you don't use the screen or your level of vision is at a point where you can't see the screen very well. I might argue it's a positive because you're not paying out for something you can't see. And I guess my question is, with those lower specifications, does that impact the quality of the accessibility? Does it take a while to, you know, boot up? I mean, you mentioned it doesn't take long to boot up the system, but what about the voice? I mean, is it reactive? Is it quick? Is it responsive enough?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's okay. I mean, it takes a little while to get going, you know. Mine actually stutters a bit at the beginning, like you've just woken her up.
They're becoming so human, these things, aren't they?
Oh, God, yeah, AI.
Got to wake them up in the morning.
I don't know, you know, because I've used kind of one set model, which is actually an Acer laptop, so it's good. It's a good make, but it is quite, it's a small screen. I mean, I would say it's pretty good quality. It's not like you say, it's not like your really expensive laptop screens or whatever, but it works for me. Now, it has a magnifier on it as well that I've used a wee bit, but I think I haven't actually tried that. You know, people that use magnifiers, their kind of needs and what they can see on the screen would vary greatly. So it would be good to kind of ask a few different people what they think of the magnifier. But I've mainly concentrated on the ChromeVox for now. But there's a lot of trying out and getting other opinions to be done.
I think when it comes to these machines, I would always recommend anybody especially a blind person, before you purchase anything, go and try it. And that's one of the great things about this, isn't it? You can go into a store like I did. And okay, I had a bit of a negative experience with it. But then, and because I had no one with me who knew anything about Chromebooks, including the staff, I couldn't tell if I was on a website that was inaccessible or whether it was something else. I had no idea. There was no knowledge to me. And I didn't know anything about ChromeVox or Chromebooks, so I wasn't going to muck around too much. But what I would say is, you know, you have a website that has got lots of resources on there. You also appear regularly on the NCBI podcast with Stuart Lawler. And, you know, you talk about different things. You give demonstrations as well. So there are lots of resources out there. And I guess then it's a case of once you've listened to that, once you've read that information, go to a store. And what is it, Control-Alt-Z?
Yes, Control-Alt-Z.
And that turns on ChromeVox. So any ChromeVox you're on in a store, do that, Control-Alt-Z, and switch it on and have a go. And you might have better results than I do. In fact, I'm almost sure you will. So on that basis then, how do people find your website and, you know, tell us more about the podcast you're on.
Yes. So my website is called sharonsshortcuts.ie. So it's sharons-shortcuts.ie. If you put Sharon's Shortcuts into Google, it should be one of the first search results, hopefully. Or maybe it is here because it's .ie. But in Ireland here. So I have basically, it's all about using a computer without the mouse. And it's kind of for everyone that wants to use the keyboard more. So it's got step-by-step instructions, standard keyboard shortcuts for a Windows PC using Office. So it's got step-by-step file management, Outlook, Word, Excel, that kind of thing. Also, I'm on the wonderful NCBI technology podcast once a month. I have my own Sharon's Shortcuts slot. And kindly Stuart Lawler, who does the NCBI technology podcast, he gives me my little slot to put onto my website. So I call them pocket podcasts because they're about 20 minutes long. And so there's a whole page, pocket podcasts. You can go back and listen to them. And they actually have a list of keyboard shortcuts, with the link. And I recently put a download link on there as well, which actually is working out very well. So I might actually get rid of the other media link. But so you have a list of shortcuts for reference, the ones that are mentioned in each pocket podcast.
Incredible.
The past 6-7 months, we've been doing Google apps and Chromebook. So last August, we talked about accessing Gmail without the mouse. And in September, we actually did an introduction to the Chromebook. So that was when I'd had a Chromebook for about 2 days. me and Stuart were just playing with the Chromebox. There's also Google Drive in October. November, we did Google Calendar. December, we did Google Docs. And in January, we actually did a collaborating on Google Docs. We had two computers, one document, and two screen readers going. And it was really interesting and very, very accessible.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's worth a listen. January 2018, NCBI Technology Podcast. Have a listen to that. But the interesting thing is, I think it was only one or two of them that we actually used the Chromebook. So you can hear the Chromebook and you can get an idea of what the voice sounds like and what Chromebox is like. But all the rest we actually did just on Chrome, on a Windows PC. And it would be very similar keyboard shortcuts and access as it would be on a Chromebook.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you wanted to learn more about using just the Google Suite and things and become more online and then start using a Chromebook, you can do it all on any machine, really, on any I generally use the Chrome browser, so I can only vouch for that. But with any screen reader,
listen, loads more we could talk about, I'm sure, but it is great to have you on the show, Sharon, and I wish you all the best, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great, thanks Stephen, all the best.
Great to have Sharon Lyons on and talking about Chromebooks. They are far more accessible by the sounds of it than perhaps we thought, guys.
Yes, look, Sharon does a fantastic job, and I love the Stuart Lawler podcast is also fantastic. There's some great stuff on there. I got to say, though, I'm still not convinced by the accessibility of Chromevox, the screen reader. I have tried it in the Chrome browser on Windows, and I do just get a lot of button. So, look, it seems like a bit of a... something I keep going back to is, if it works for you, then fantastic. And it's great to have these, depending on which model you get, the more cheaper options out there, like the Amazon Fire tablet that we've talked about previously. Great to have the option there. But for me, the accessibility isn't quite there yet. And that is a problem for me.
But from what she describes, it does sound like it's better than even I thought it was. So am I totally convinced that I could use it every day, like you said, Sean, because you're still going to get that button response? Yeah, I'm not quite there yet to use it maybe every day, but I am a little bit more hopeful that that I could use this if I needed to, based on what she was describing. So where I was with it, she's actually helped me feel a little bit better about it.
Okay. Well, lots more on that to come, I'm sure. Tell us your thoughts if you've got a Chromebook. I know some of you do. Well, get in touch, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, and prove us wrong. Right, time for this, guys.
News from the internet.
And there's lots of it. And in particular this week, Facebook is in the news, of course. It's been in the news for a couple of weeks. We didn't get it till last week, of course, because we had the RNIB in Your Pocket special. But yeah, Facebook has gone from being, oh, that amazing thing, you know, that we share all our lives on, to, hang on a minute, how much have I shared and who has it? And, you know, why is there a guy at the door kind of thing? And I have to say, this story has made me rather nervous. Let me explain for those who haven't been following this. I know some people tune into the show for the news. Cambridge Analytica is the name you might have heard. This is a company that has been working alongside Facebook, apparently. And what both companies are now at the centre of this dispute over alleged harvesting and use of personal data. Now, both companies deny any wrongdoing. They say that nothing has actually gone wrong here. But just to explain why this is significant, because you've probably heard about this before, data mining or harvesting of data, what that data is. I guess we just think, well, it doesn't affect me, it's got no impact on me. Well, the way that this harvested data might have been used is the concern. It was allegedly utilised to direct messages for political campaigns supported by Cambridge Analytica and their clients, most notably Trump's election victory and the Brexit vote. Now, those are two significant votes, obviously, but what the question is here is, how were they using this data? Were they using it to target individuals in the way that we've heard about from Russian hacking and all of that kind of thing? Is it as extreme as that? Or is it a case of they've been actually able to identify trends in our lives because of the data we have? And that's the concerning bit, I guess, guys. I mean, you know, what do you think?
It's tricky. Because you could make the argument this is just advertising done to perfection. Because what they could say is that they are just targeting really well and really specifically the people that they think that their information is going to affect more. Now, of course, the problem here is, how are they getting that information on who they're sending their information to? The thing with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook is that Cambridge Analytica did approach people that did give them permission to access their data for a small fee. But what they could do from there was access all their friends list data as well. So a relatively small amount of people which did volunteer to give their information up freely, they were able to mine millions of people's data from those, from a relatively small group, which Facebook shouldn't have allowed to happen, which is where Facebook becomes under fire. And aside from that, it's the amount of data and sort of hidden data that you wouldn't expect Facebook to have. There's been a revelation that, call data and SMS data, all the logs, not the actual calls or the content of the messages themselves, but the logs of when and where and who, that's been gathered by Facebook on Android handsets for a long time. So that's sort of information you wouldn't expect. And, who reads the terms and conditions? Maybe it's in there. I don't know. But there's a lot of hidden data that are stored. And I think people are suddenly realizing, hang on, how do you know that much about me? And people are sort of waking up to the privacy and the amount of data that we give away.
Sean's right. There is kind of a good and a bad to this because, this is something Google's been doing for, forever, where they track what your searches are. They look and see what kind of searches you do and the information you're looking at on Google. And then they tailor the advertisements that you see and the pop-ups that you see to the things that you search. And in a way, that's a good thing. You want there to be things tailored to your likes. I don't want to go on there and have an advertisement that has absolutely nothing to do with anything I like. If they're going to give me an advertisement, I'm happy to have it be something that I might be interested in. But that being said, Sean's right. You're giving your information away, and how much are you giving? Every time you allow Facebook to access, you know, third-party apps, or you put up information on Facebook or share anything, you know, you've got to really be aware of what you're sharing and where that information might be going and how it might be being used. And I think you're right, Sean. Facebook, even though they say they didn't feel they did anything wrong here, they really should have been protecting data more. Now, like we said, the terms and conditions might have allowed some of this to happen, and we're just, you know, kind of putting up our information willy-nilly, but Facebook really should have taken extra measures to make sure that our data wasn't being used improperly.
Yeah, well, they will argue they have been doing that. And of course, they've said that there is no wrongdoing here. But I think it does raise interesting questions about what happens with our data. And data that we willingly hand over and data that we unwillingly or unwittingly hand over, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is perhaps more of a concern, as you say, Sean, because that call data, you know, it's not necessarily that we know, or they know, I should say, Facebook or any company would know the content of the calls. There's no suggestion of that. But what I was reading an article about this, and it was trying to explain why this is relevant. You know, so if someone figures out that I've called my mum today, is that a big deal? I mean, does it? If some company knows that, does that really make a difference? Well, what they've suggested is that it's not so much about that. It's not so much that they know I've called my mum, but they know when I've called her. They know how many times I call her, roughly the time I would call her. They don't know even necessarily who I'm calling, but they can build a picture out of this data. So for example, the company might know, for example, when I'm most active or when I'm at work, because, you know, I might make calls, more calls within a 9-to-5 period than outside that. So those, and again, you say, well, again, so what? But I suppose it's a bit like walking into your house and there's a burglar standing there and he says, well, you know, I utilized all your data, I pulled it all together, and, you know, I've come up with the conclusion that you'd be out at this point. And you say, well done, sir, well done, take the TV and that DVD player, I don't use it anymore. You wouldn't do that. You'd be horrified, because that person would be able to, in the way that burglars actually do, in some cases, watch you and watch your pattern. That's kind of what's happening here in a data sense. And the question is, what is happening with that data? How are we being influenced in elections? How are we being influenced in our purchasing, in our intake of news? All of these things, big, big questions.
Well, that's scary questions, I think.
Yeah, those are bigger, scarier things, exactly, because then you're looking at specific targeting advertisements that might not be, hey, we see you search for, you know, headphones or laptops a lot, we're going to advertise web, you know, those things on the web. It comes down to, like you said, election type advertisements and trying to convince you of a certain frame of mind or things that may or may not even be true, which is what happened, of course, with these elections that we're talking about here in the States and in Brexit. So, yeah, it is something that's terrifying, because then you're saying, well, now we're talking about social engineering, and that's a bigger, scarier thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's terrifying stuff. Okay, I don't want to frighten you anymore. You know, I always feel that, I feel now we're talking about stories more and more now that I have to almost say at the end, please come back out from under the couch. Everything's
don't have
okay. Don't have nightmares. Everything will be fine.
Tech can be your friend, yes.
It can be, but, you know, just don't connect it to Wi-Fi. No, I'm only kidding. But, okay, well, that's one story this week, and I did want to bring it up because it is an important one, and I think it's just, I guess the takeaway is we just have to be so mindful of what we put up there and the information that we give. But I think also it's on the companies to make sure that they tell us. I mean, I think I would want to know. I would want to know if my call data is being given to Facebook. I have no idea how that would happen. I still don't really understand how I can search for something on a company's website and then on Facebook I get an ad for that product from that company on in
my
feed.
It's all to do with your favourite thing, Stephen, cookies.
Hey, indeed. Yes. Well, you can explain that to me on another day, but obviously not the ones that I eat, because I get that. Let's go on to some other stories. This is a kind of political story, I suppose. Access to Work is a scheme in the UK, Tim. You might have heard of it. But in the UK, yes, it's a scheme which a lot of people might not even be aware of. It's a brilliant scheme, almost Britain's best kept secret in some cases. if you go into a job, there is support, financial support there if you're disabled, to help you achieve in work and actually, you know, as the scheme suggests, get access to work. Now, that can come in various forms. It can come in physical support, as in someone with you, a support worker. You can get taxi support to work if you struggle to use public transport, as we all would. You would get taxi support. And you also get equipment support. And that can be quite important. And this is often why, when we talk about Braille and we talk about specialist software or specialist hardware, we often follow that conversation with, and of course it's so expensive. And one of the reasons we think it's so expensive is because big business like Humanware and all the rest, they are able to put their prices set at the level they are purely because of the fact that it's governments that are paying for it, essentially. The majority of purchases come from governments. So I'm not saying that the prices are set to match, you know, what a government would spend, because I know that there's other reasons why. I mean, Humanware, for example, you know, it's a niche product, let's be fair. They're not going to sell a million units a year, I wouldn't imagine, of Braille displays.
Yeah, it's, and of course, research and design, they would argue,
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, yeah. So that all goes into the cost. And of course, if there was a million units being sold every year, the price would come down. But they don't. So you have these schemes, and this particular one is called Access to Work. It is a brilliant idea. Last year, and a couple of years before that, the scheme was cut. The amount per year you were able to receive was chopped down to about $42,000 a year, which sounds like a lot of money. You think, hang on a minute, $42,000 a year? I don't even earn that. But if you take into account a support worker, a taxi journey every day, and a couple of Braille display and a copy of Jaws, then you're probably reaching that pretty easily. The good news is the government has announced that that scheme is being increased. The amount per person is being increased up to $57,000 per year. And that kicks in for new claimants from April. So if you're going into a job, if you're in a job and looking to renew your access to work, then after April, certainly you'll get more options there, because there'll be more money flying around, which is fantastic news for all of us. And yeah, it's great news. I won't say thank you to the government for doing it, but I will say it's about time, perhaps, they did it.
It makes such a difference, though. I mean, not just from a, you know, monetary point of view, just for someone's social and self-worth point of view. I think it's such a good scheme, this.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, we've got an email coming up later, which kind of ties into that. So look forward to reading that one. Also, just a couple of other stories before we get to your emails. Google has announced a new text-to-speech service, and it has more realistic voices, 32 new voices, in fact, which is rather interesting. I guess that is related to its Android phones, which could be good, I guess.
They're really realistic sounding, and they're all contextual as well.
Have you heard them?
I've heard them. There was a demo on their blog post a while back, giving a few samples out, and they were really good. They would be really processor intensive, though. I could see them taking up a lot of processing power. But yeah, speech synths are getting really good.
Yeah, they are quite realistic. I did hear a demo actually on YouTube of what these sound like, and they are really, really good. I agree with Sean, though. A lot of processing power, a lot of RAM. If you've got a whole lot of RAM, then you might be okay with this. But it's nice to see that this is being looked at and developed, because it shows the future of what this, you know, what these voices could really be.
Okay, and Google Home, good news if you've got one of those. I've got one of the little minis, still in a drawer. That's shocking, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. Take it out of that drawer. You should be ashamed of yourself.
No, I put it in the drawer. I kind of got bored with it, and now I it's because I use the other one. I use the Amazon one all the time. So, you know, I don't
use
the
both.
Google one. Yeah, I know, I should. But now the good news is it can stream to any Bluetooth speaker. An update has come in, and that allows you to do that. That's good news, actually, because there's no output on it, is there?
Whoa! Really? That's fantastic news, including the Google Home Mini.
Yes, that's right.
Ah, well, I'm amazed. That also comes along with the Amazon Echo, the first generation. If you're in the UK, that is.
Yeah.
Didn't have any Bluetooth out. Well, in a recent update, it enabled Bluetooth out from the Amazon Echo as well. So, that is fantastic news, because that's one thing I thought the Google Home Mini was definitely missing.
Well, obviously, you've got music in there. You know, you want to hear it maybe on a better speaker. It's not a bad speaker than the Google Home Mini.
No.
Not bad at all, actually. Compared to the Amazon Echo, the Dot, anyway, I think... I'm going to say something really controversial here. I haven't done this for a while. I'm not a big fan of the Echo speaker. Is that shocking?
Well, no, the Dot is pretty terrible.
No, I'm talking about Echo Medium. You know, like...
What?
Well, you know, not the dot, not the big massive plus, but the one in the middle. Just the little one.
The Echo. Sorry, I didn't realise you were using your Stevenisms there.
No, yes, I was using words that other people understand that you don't, obviously.
Medium.
Yeah.
I think it sounds good.
Fine. Tim?
There you go. I disagree.
I don't have problems with it. I mean, I think it's a fine speaker. Is it, you know, is it as good as it could be? Is it as good as maybe a Sonos or the Apple HomePod?
Nope.
No, obviously not. But is it good enough to get by to listen to music and podcasts? I think it's fine.
Ah, your standards are on the floor. Okay. Well, that's the news. We shall move on now to these.
Email. We get email. Get your email every day.
Right, let's get into it then.
Here's your mail today.
Time for the mail. And hello to Simon today, who got in touch with us. He says, hi, Steve and gang. As ever, a brilliant and inspiring show. Oh, stop it. I've been thinking and... Oh, he's been thinking. Oh, dear. And so it is time to batten down the hatches, he says. I think that Microsoft is trying to kill the home PC market. Now, in recent times, he says, they have done some brilliant work regarding seeing AI and, of course, Soundscape more recently. But what of Windows? Why do they seem to take so long to deal with what is their Nest, essentially? Narrator is about 23 years old, and whilst it is being worked on and improved, can you think of any other program of that age that is not so feature-rich and clogged down with graphics that has become unusable? By comparison, Narrator is positively... emaciated. Of course, I'm thinking of Norton or the latest version of Skype as well. Mm-hmm. It says, under Windows 10, the apps, to my experience, are unusable. I may be missing some NVDA plugins, I admit, but don't know which ones. Lastly, can you think of a single thing that you cannot more easily achieve using a tablet or smartphone and a Bluetooth keyboard? I can't. Just putting that out there. Keep up the great work. Best wishes, Simon.
Good points.
Ooh, not a fan of Narrator there. I must admit, even though Narrator has improved significantly, I still find it unresponsive and slow to use. It, I find myself waiting for it. And, you know, if anyone that uses a screen reader, that's so frustrating, waiting for it to catch you up. So, yeah, I sort of agree with that. I think there are improvements coming up in the next update of Windows 10. There are some more improvements to Narrator as well as other accessibility improvements. So we'll have to wait and see. Windows 10 apps, yeah, I find they are a struggle to navigate.
Yeah, because Tim, you use both, you use JAWS at work and use NVDA at home, but do you use Narrator at all?
I have tried to use Narrator, especially since Microsoft seems to be committed to trying to give updates to it. And as Sean said, it's still just not as responsive as NVDA or JAWS. It's still a little clunky, quite honestly. Now, that being said, with what Microsoft has been doing with smartphone apps, I'm hopeful that they will start a commitment to Narrator, continue their commitment to Narrator, and keep updating it. And maybe it will get to a point where it'll be similar to an NVDA. But right now, yeah, it's just not as responsive. And if I have to use it, if I go to someone else's house and I need a quick access to their computer with a screen reader, it's fine. It's good in a pinch to use to navigate and get through what I need to get through, but to use it regularly on an ongoing basis, no. And I do have to agree to a certain extent what Simon said there in the email. If you've got a Bluetooth keyboard and a smartphone or a tablet, in most cases, that's probably all you need. You're going to feel better, I think, about that experience and trying to navigate some of these Windows apps. But you know, hopefully they'll continue to develop it and get better.
You know, I have to say, I have been thinking about this for a long time. I'm with you on this, Simon. I much prefer using my phone and my keyboard, my little Microsoft Universal keyboard that I've got. I love it. That with my AirPods in, or maybe actually not the AirPods, a hardwired AirPods or whatever, just because I have noticed a bit of that lag people are talking about, especially when typing quickly. So for that reason, that is brilliant for me. That is perfect. And the only thing I have in my life that's a problem is editing. You can't, that I'm aware of anyway, accessibly edit audio on an iPad without sight. I think you can do it if you're sighted.
No, that's awkward. Exactly where the desktop or the Windows PC comes in, is because, or even a Mac, it's because of the trying to create content on a tablet or something like that, I think the power is there. The processor power and the hard disk space and the cloud storage is all there. It's just finding an interface and a good way to do it.
There is
just using the keyboard or the touch screen.
Yeah, there is one good app that I have found called Hakusai that you can edit audio in, but it's not as easy and streamlined as, of course, doing it on a PC or a Mac. You can do it. You can clip out audio and do different things with it and paste in things and edit. But it's, again, just, is it possible? Yes. Is it as easy as doing it on a computer? No. So it's there. Like you said, Sean, the processing power is there. It's just maybe not as easy. So there are certain things that you may want to continue doing on a desktop. But quite honestly, like I said before, and like you said, Stephen, I'm quite happy just to use my phone or tablet. I rarely use a desktop anymore unless I absolutely have to.
Kelly and Matthew, you had some great emails that you both sent in, as did a lot other of you. And I want to get to those, but we're not going to get time in this show. So we'll save them for next week and we'll kick off the show with those next week. I just wanted to pick up on one thing that Tim said at the beginning of last week's show. In fact, the week before show, I should say, which was, where was Stephen? Where was I? Apparently, there was great concern about my whereabouts. Well, I got some emails in because Tim requested that you send in some emails, so we did. Rebecca got in touch saying Stephen is secretly attending CSUN and then stopping by Chicago to hear the Apple event. I wish.
You wish.
He will find something that is premiering the UK first and wanted to be the first to share. I wish that were true, but I'm afraid it's not. Also, Beth got in touch to say, hi guys, I think Stephen went skydiving. What? very rarely going near the sky, especially diving out of it. So no, sadly not, Beth. But
unless you were in a plane and they were throwing cookies out the side or throwing
tempting as that may be
after it,
even I might say no to that one. But Jules gets the award for his email, who says, you wanted to know where Stephen has really gone whilst allegedly on holiday. I think the answer is really rather obvious. He said in a previous broadcast that he wanted to spend more time talking about Android, clearly a major system error. Undoubtedly the nearest Apple maintenance facility issued an emergency recall and his core programming made him return there. I think we can be confident that at this very moment he is having a deep virus scan, memory defragmentation, and his trash can emptied. He may even get an operating system upgrade. When he gets back, I think you will find him running faster, smoother, and more importantly, fully Apple compliant. Tech Talk loyalists, you can breathe easy. Just like the $6 million man, they can rebuild him. Good luck to all. Beware OS bugs. Julian. Julian, thank you.
Fantastic.
Brilliant. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much for that. That was great. Thanks to everybody, actually, for responding to that. That was great.
Absolutely. We'll catch you next time on Tech Talk. Remember the new podcast, RNIB Tech Talk, and keep in touch by email, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. See you next week, guys.
Bye-bye.